Hello, podcast people. Brendan here.
And Rico, we've got a great show coming up featuring The Daily Show's Jessica Williams and many, many others.
Spoiler alert, Dick Cavett 2.
Oh, yes.
And at one point, they answer your etiquette questions together. It's amazing.
That's right. It's like a super polite Wonder Twins, those two.
Mm-hmm.
But we have something to run by you first. So we love to say that the cultural conversations on this show can help you win your dinner parties, you know, because we leave your brain brimming with fascinating items to talk about. Yes.
Well, some of the great minds at our company have thought of a more tangible way we can help you.
That's right.
The idea, team up with Quarterly, that's a box subscription service, to create one-of-a-kind boxes of curated items that would be shipped directly to you 4 times a year.
Yes. It would work like a CSA, but instead of kale, you might get new music or art or recipes or other amazing stuff to sate your cultural appetite.
Get it?
Mm-hmm. Do you see? Each box will be dedicated to a theme and designed to help make your parties a smashing success. The other cool part of this, by the way, is that when you subscribe to the box, you would be supporting our show.
I think that's the coolest part of it.
Me too.
But all the stuff's pretty cool. We're gauging interest in this idea now. So if you want to see these boxes become a reality, please go to dinnerpartydownload.org. You'll find a quick link there where you can say you dig the idea and make suggestions for what you'd like to receive in a box. Please, legal items only.
That's right, you scamps. There's no obligation, but it'll help us plan ahead. Thanks a lot. And now, here's your icebreaker.
It's a married couple. They've been together 5 years. It's their anniversary, and things are not going well. They're just having a lot of fights about money and about everything. It's just, oh, they're just putting a brave face on, and they go out to dinner, and they get a bottle of wine, and they're sitting there, and they're not talking too much, and they're drinking the wine, and suddenly, out of nowhere, the wife says, God, I love you. I don't know what I would do without you. And the man says, wow, is that you talking, or is that the wine talking? She said, that's me talking to the wine.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. And from APM, American Public Media, this is The Dinner Party Download, the culture show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations.
You just got a joke from actor Michael McKean.
Yeah.
That'll help break the ice. The Spinal Tap star takes on a far darker role in his latest stage appearance, and we'll speak with him about that later. Mm. Plus, you'll hear the best moments from our recent live show in New York City, including Jessica Williams, senior correspondent for The Daily Show, giving our audience some tough love.
Also coming up, talk show legend Dick Cavett talks about playing Dick Cavett. Comedian Jen Kirkman tells us how attempted blackmail changed her life. And singer-songwriter Emmy the Great plays us an appropriately great track off her new album.
But first, let's start with small talk. All week long, you've been hearing these headlines.
Lemonade, the highly anticipated release by Beyonce.
Clinton and Trump head toward consolidating their nominations.
The Pentagon is sending about 250 more special operations troops to Syria.
Now for something you might not have heard, we're joined by Britain's own Helen Zaltzman. She hosts The Illusionist, a show about language, which was named one of iTunes' best podcasts of 2015. And she's one of many podcasters appearing at Radiotopia Live this Wednesday at the Theater at Ace Hotel in Los Angeles. Helen, what story are you going to be talking about at parties this weekend?
Well, Britain's spy agencies are under investigation at the moment for all the surveillance they've been doing over the years that possibly they weren't supposed to be.
Mm.
They've been collecting people's medical information, phone records and stuff. And it turns out that spies have been illicitly accessing this huge bank of data so they can look up the birth dates and addresses of people they need to send birthday cards to.
What?
Yeah.
What? Isn't there a phone book or something for that?
A birthday phone book. Well, that's kind of what Facebook's for, but my birthday's not on there, so no one remembers. And every year I think, oh, why didn't they just chat with the spies?
But wait, so what is happening?
So spies are using this very sophisticated surveillance stuff for pretty mundane tasks. That's what.
Yeah, because if you're thinking, well, which day's my mother-in-law's birthday, the 10th or the 12th, it's too embarrassing to ask her.
Much better to get that information by invading her privacy.
Totally.
I just want my niece and nephews to know the reason they don't get birthday cards is because I respect their privacy.
Yeah, you're a good man, Noonan. But wait, so they're not doing it to random people. They're doing it to their own family members?
Yeah, their own family members, their friends, even their coworkers.
Now, Rico, that would be a conspiracy of a different order if they were looking up other people's birthdays to send them birthday cards.
Yeah.
That'd be quite sweet.
Yeah, like I was thinking maybe the people they were spying upon, they're like, you know, I feel bad.
Yeah.
Maybe I should send them an anonymous birthday
They're
card.
Like, you know what? I think we can reduce terrorism by more hugs and just some kind notes once in a while.
I think it's the soft way to get people comfortable with constant surveillance.
Yes.
Helen Zaltzman, thank you for this creepy yet delightful story.
You're very welcome.
And now, time for cocktails.
Once again, we tell you a true tale from history, then give you a fitting drink to serve along with it.
It's our famed history lesson with booze.
We'll start with the history part. All 33 right. years ago this week, several major news outlets published a story that quickly cost them their reputations.
Michelle Phillippe tells the tale.
In 1983, the scoop of the century turned out to be the dupe of the century. It all began at the German news magazine Stern when their reporter, Gerd Heidemann, announced he'd met a guy who had in his possession the wartime diaries of Adolf Hitler. And they were for sale for a mere several million German marks. Once experts authenticated the handwriting, Stern paid up. Then it offered the syndication rights to news outlets like London's Sunday Times, which sent its own expert, who also said the diaries were for real. How could they not be? After all, no one would fake 62 handwritten notebooks, right? Well, as some pointed out, a couple of Italian ladies faked 80 volumes of Mussolini's diaries back in 1957. But despite such doubts, Stern and the Times published excerpts from the Hitler diaries anyway. Many cried fraud. The events in the diaries didn't jibe with documented history. Hitler came off as an almost genial guy. Historians and scientists demanded a closer look at the diaries. And, as a British historian later told BBC host Sue McGregor, forensics quickly proved they were forged, written on modern paper with modern ink.
So it took an hour to declare these documents a fake.
That's true.
Turns out, when Stern's experts first examined the diaries, they had checked the handwriting against what they thought were original documents. But those had also been forged by the same guy who forged the diaries, a man named Konrad Kujau. He served 2 years in prison for fraud, after which he made a living making replicas of famous paintings, which he admitted up front were fakes.
So that was the history. Now for the drink to serve along with it. I'm speaking with Uwe Christensen. He is owner of Christensen's Fine Drinks and Cocktails in Hamburg, Germany, which is where Stern is still headquartered. Uwe, you heard the history. What drink did that inspire you to make?
Well, I thought the story was kind of a fraud and everything was wrong. And so I made a drink which is a bit similar to a Moscow mule, but different. And that's why I call it a Hamburg mule.
I see. So it's a fraudulent Moscow mule.
It is, yes.
All right. So what's in this drink?
Well, first of all, we have ginger beer inside. But you're not allowed to call ginger beer in Germany beer because it's not a beer, it's a lemonade.
So it's kind of a fake beer, too.
Yeah, so we have to call ginger beer in Germany something different, like spicy ginger or bee point or whatever.
Okay.
So that's the first thing, that's not real.
All right, so we're starting right away with something that's not real. And nice job.
And usually it's vodka in the Moscow Mule. I put in corn. It's made in Germany, and it's a kind of a grain spirit, which is even a bit better than vodka. It's
if you do say so yourself.
Yes.
All right, so we've got the ginger beer and we've got the corn, and now what?
There was another thing I came up with. The paper that you use for a newspaper is made out of pulp, and I used pulp of a kumquat, this little mini oranges.
Oh, so you got the pulp of the kumquat in there?
Yeah.
So it'll be kind of a cloudy drink.
It gives you a slightly bitter taste, yeah.
All right. And
then I've got two slices of fresh lime, because this drink you will remember because it's really spicy. It's a fresh drink, but it's also quite sharp. Yeah.
We'll never forget this drink. Interestingly, though, I mean, I lived through this fake Hitler's diary publication, and I'd totally forgotten about it until we started researching this history. Have people there in Hamburg? Do they still remember this?
Not really. It still comes out from time to time. And Stern, I think, is still not very happy if it comes up.
But on the other hand, they've set the bar low, right? Like any time they make a mistake, they can say, hey, at least it's not the Hitler diaries.
Yeah.
I'm Brendan, there's a kicker to the Hitler Diaries story.
Can't wait to hear this.
The guy who forged those diaries, Konrad Kujau, we mentioned he later kind of traded in on his notoriety by selling replicas he made of famous paintings, right?
Yeah.
Well, he passed away, and a few years back, a woman got in trouble for selling fakes of his fake paintings.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. She was forging his signature on her own replica painting.
So a forger was forging another forger's forgeries.
Yes.
That seems harder than just doing something original. I know.
Just do it.
Maybe that is original.
Anyway, folks, if you want to forge that drink, we've got the recipe for the Hamburg Mule at dinnerpartydownload.org.
And now, time to eavesdrop.
You may have seen Jen Kirkman appear on the talk show Chelsea Lately, or confusing Richard Dreyfuss with Frederick Douglass in the series Drunk History. Her new book is called I Know What I'm Doing and Other Lies I Tell Myself. Today, we overhear an excerpt.
Hi, this is Jen Kirkman, and this is a story about how losing my phone led to the end of my marriage. So I'm at Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut with my parents, and I'm gambling at the Sex and the City machine with my father, like most fathers and daughters do. I had been texting with someone the entire time. Now, I was married at the time, and the person I was texting, let's call him Kevin. This man and I were having what you would call maybe an emotional flirtation. I had originally met Kevin months earlier when I went to New York City to do a comedy show, but Kevin and I had exchanged numbers and emails, and I was telling Kevin every detail about how unhappy I was being married, and Kevin, who had been divorced himself, was telling me what the divorce process is like, and that now he's just a free spirit guy who lives in upstate New York. Now, I had a trip coming up to New York City, and we were texting about it, and the texts were a little flirtatious. Things like, I'm not sleeping with you. I know that, Jen. We just said we'd meet up for a drink. Okay, I'm just letting you know. And I wasn't paying attention to the game, and then I left my phone somewhere. So I'm in my hotel room and I decide, oh, I'll just call the number and I bet some nice old lady who's downstairs playing bingo will have it. And instead, a man answered and I said, hello, who's this? And he said, this is Jose. And I said, okay, well, this is Jen. I'm the owner of the phone. And he said, oh, I know who you are, Jen Kirkman. I know you from television. And so I was like, oh, thanks for being a fan. And you know what? I'll give you $50 for giving me my phone back. And he said,
$50? Well, you're rich and famous. I want $5,000.
Which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, isn't that much money. But when you have a joint checking account with your husband, suddenly withdrawing $5,000 doesn't really fly. But I just agreed to meet Jose outside of Radio City Music Hall the next day and just figure it out. So I was having lunch with a girlfriend the next day, and I was telling her about my problem and that I was freaking out and I was going to have to tell my husband in the most awkward way that I wanted to end the marriage. And the reason that I had to tell him right now was because these messages were about to be exposed, but I wasn't really having an affair, just sort of an emotional thing. And my friend said, wait a minute, the guy that works in my office building used to be an undercover cop. Maybe he can help us. He called two of his undercover cop friends. And so we arranged to meet an hour before I was supposed to meet Jose outside of Radio City Music Hall to set up our sting. Now, when I met with these guys, I just saw them on the street and I waved like a dork, are you the undercover cops? And they walked into a bodega and I followed them. And talking between the food aisles, they were saying to me, don't look us in the eye. Don't walk near us. I will be standing in the lobby of Radio City looking at brochures. Undercover cop number one is going to be on the other side of the street. Now, Jen, you'll be on this corner. And when Jose comes over to you, pretend to give him the payment. That's when we want you to toss your hat in the air and we'll come out and handcuff him. So it was like a bizarre, immoral Mary Tyler Moore opening credit scene. And so I get there and Jose's not showing up. And after about 45 minutes, the undercover cops, they finally stood next to me and they said, the sting is over. So I'm walking away with the two undercover cops. the main undercover cop, we'd actually gotten to know each other a little bit that afternoon. And he said to me, I don't mean to pry, but there must have been something really important on that phone for you to go to all this trouble. What does your husband say about this? And I asked him, how did you know I was married? And he said, you're wearing a wedding ring. And I was like, oh, right. And he's like, I mean, we are intuitive. That's our job. You know, we have to go with our guts in certain situations. And he said that with no sense of irony as he was adjusting his pants to make room for his actual gut. But he said to me, I know it's not my business, but whatever is going on, it seems like something that I can't give advice about, but that you might need to follow your gut on. And after he gave me that advice, we kept walking with our coffees. And I kid you not, as we rounded the corner, there was a homeless man sitting on a crate playing a saxophone. It was a perfect New York moment. And I realized that I did have to follow my gut. And when I returned home from New York City, I said for the first time to my husband, I don't think this is working out.
Jen Kirkman, her new book is called I Know What I'm Doing and Other Lies I Tell Myself. It's out now.
And folks, if you're listening to this amazing sax solo on the radio, know that you can replay it as many times as you like and hear bonus episodes and extended cuts of our show by subscribing to our podcast. You can do that on iTunes or use the podcast app right on your phone.
If you haven't lost it.
That's right.
Meanwhile, coming up, three scintillating party guests, Jessica Williams, Dick Cavett, and Michael McKeon, when the Dinner Party Download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the arts and leisure section of public radio. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. In a few minutes, actor Michael McKeon explains how he went from Laverne and Shirley to his latest dramatic role. But first, the other week we were privileged to tape our show live in New York City at WNYC's The Green Space, and we're going to play a few highlights from that show throughout this episode, starting with this, our chat with Jessica Williams.
She co-hosts the new podcast Two Dope Queens, but it's in her role as senior correspondent for The Daily Show that she's become America's favorite fake news reporter.
That's right.
Jessica aims her arsenal of quick wit and righteous indignation at everything from politics and race to Beyonce.
Here's a clip in which she tells host John Oliver that she wants to see the NYPD's stop and frisk profiling policy expanded to include the stopping and frisking of Wall Street types who might possibly be white-collar criminals.
John, I hate to say it because I don't live in their neighborhoods or experience the problems specific to their lives.
That's right, you don't. So, you don't.
But it is a hard fact that white-collar crime is disproportionately committed by people who fit a certain profile.
Hey, hey.
So if you're, say, white, Upper East Side billionaire with ties to the financial community like Michael Bloomberg, you just got to accept getting roughed up by the police every once in a while. You know, for everyone's safety.
That piece aired in 2013.
Amazing.
And Jessica says it's the first time she felt she truly found her voice on The Daily Show. We asked her why.
When I first got hired at the show, I was 22, and I didn't really know like what my character's shtick was. So for a while, I would just go into John Stewart's office every now and then and just be like, hey, like, what's my deal? And he'd be like, what? And I'd be like, what's like my thing? And he was just like, you're 22, you're going to figure it out. Just look for the things that make you feel emotions. And I was like, psh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't know what all those Emmys
were
for.
You're like CrossFit.
Yeah, like, come on, dude. Oh, come on, Dad. Yeah, but that was sort of the stop and frisk policy that was enacted at the time. It was very frustrating, and that was really sort of the first bit where I felt like, oh, damn, like, this might be my thing.
Do you have, like, a lens where you're just like, I know that's not a Jessica Williams story?
Yeah, I do. Like, I can't. I'm 26, so I can't deal with the economy or, like, money. Like, I can't.
You just have never had
like,
any.
I just figured out my taxes, barely. And by figured it out, like, I finally called my mom to thank her for helping me with my taxes.
That's off limits.
I'm just not ready for it.
Do you have a theory about why fake news and satire, like, the left really takes to that?
Well, I think
for their politics.
It's always been that way. It's not, you know, I think comedy has always been about those that feel a little bit more disenfranchised and slighted, trying to find a way through pain. It's why, like, sometimes I really like to dig into Fox News's Facebook page because it's really lit with, like, really angry people that don't get it. But the things that they have to post comedy-wise are like terrible. Like there's nothing, like the memes are bad.
Yeah.
You know, none of it is really coming from a frame of reference that actually seems like it's struggling in any sort of way. Yeah. It's just like Hillary Clinton's a goblin. Isn't that funny? And it's like, well, no. It's not. There are funnier things.
On your Twitter account, you pinned a tweet that you wrote back in February 2015. It stuck to the very top of your Twitter profile page is what that means. Mm-hmm. And you wrote it right around the time some people were suggesting you be the next Daily Show host. Mm-hmm. And it says, quote, I am a black woman and I am a feminist and I am so many things. I am truly honored people love my work, but I am not yours.
Yeah.
What did that message mean to you then and now?
I think, you know, when John announced that he was retiring, a lot of people were like, oh, you know, you kick your job, thank you. You're black and you're a woman, you should want that job. Mm-hmm. And I felt like you didn't ask me. Mm. And I felt like if I said you didn't ask me, then I felt people were condescending to me and telling me that I should want it. At first I was like, well, maybe I should want that. Maybe I should want that job. What's
because you're in this
me?
Rare position in a way.
Yeah, totally. And I was like, well, no, I don't have to. I go to therapy like 2 times a week and I love it. Highly recommend therapy. Hi, Heather.
She's our next guest.
That's so embarrassing. One time I ran into my therapist in an olive oil shop in Park Slope, and it was devastating experience of my life.
Which part's embarrassing?
All of it. Yeah. It was like Sunday.
And you said the right has nothing to make fun of.
Yeah, like, I know.
you just provided it.
Writes itself.
Hey, just want to let you guys know, anybody on the Fox News page, if you guys post it, please don't make fun of this.
Yeah.
But it was embarrassing for multiple levels.
Yeah.
And
I can't remember what the question was that we just asked you, but I do know.
To sum it up, I basically just wanted people to feel like, I am a black woman, but there are so many black female comedians, and I love that you love my work, but I don't belong to you, and I hope that you trust that I'm able to make the best possible decisions for myself.
You have an acting career outside of The Daily Show, and it started long before The Daily Show, though you were the youngest correspondent, and you were the star of a Nickelodeon comedy about a girls' soccer team.
Here comes the title.
Just for Kicks.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Do you get it? It was like a play on words.
Yeah. It's pretty. Yeah. And it's a public radio crowd.
And you really did. You scrubbed the internet and hid everything, but we dug deep and we found a clip to embarrass you with.
Get out of here.
And in this clip, one of your teammates has just made a bad play and your coach is not pleased
How
with you.
How did you get Sorry. This? Oh, no. I hate you guys.
That's it. It's over. I am officially useless.
Man, I hate losing, but I've never seen anything like that.
One more loss and he'll be naked.
One more loss and he'll be naked.
Oh, that's...
Woo! I sounded like the lady from the Popeye's chicken commercial.
I think the writing's a little better on The Daily Show.
Yeah, you come up in the world, but it did. I mean, like, the point of the show was kind of to show people of all different classes and races getting together on one team, I think.
Yeah,
sort of
in New York City. It took place in New York City, and... it was supposed to be like Sex in the City, but for girls that want to play soccer. So every girl's different.
That seems terrible. That's a terrible idea.
It was canceled after one season.
Yeah.
All right, there you go.
But I remember when it got canceled, I was like 15, and I was like, I am never going to act again. Like, I cried. I was like, this is the end for me. Like, if they don't love me like that, how will they love me? Mm. You know, how will I love myself? What a journey I've been on.
It's really true.
It's like RuPaul says, you know, how are you going to love somebody if you can't love yourself?
You can't.
Great show.
Good question.
Great show.
All right. We have two standard questions that we ask all guests on our show. And the first one is, I think I know the answer to this question. If we were to meet you at a dinner party, what question should we not ask you? Probably about that show.
If you can touch my hair, no. And also, I hate getting catcalled. Okay. So I hate you got a man, and it's like doesn't matter. I mean, never will this happen. Yeah. Once I was walking down the street, and there was this tiny man, and it was just me and him, and I'm 6 foot tall, and he was walking towards me, and I was walking towards him, and then he was like, "Hey, what's up, girl?" And I was like, "Nothing." I'm like walking on my commute, like excuse me, and I was walking, and he yells after me, like we pass each other, and he's like, "So let me get this straight. You probably only date tall dudes, right?" And I was like, "Yeah." And then all he did was point to himself and he went, "So no?" And I was like, like, no. And he was like, all right, baby, you stay blessed. See you later.
That's
and
nice.
Then he like floated into like the beautiful world that he crawled out
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
Where every man is like a delightful catcall.
Yeah.
Second question.
We have another question.
Love it. Go ahead.
Tell us something we don't know.
About me?
Or the world at large. Actually, it could be trivia about anything.
About the world. I've probably seen about 75% of all the Keeping Up with the Kardashian episodes.
Oh, I have. Interesting.
I love watching Caitlyn Jenner and observing Caitlyn Jenner from the perspective of knowing how things change in 7 years
mm-hmm.
and observing like Caitlyn Jenner then and seeing how Caitlyn Jenner functions in the household.
You're making this sound like a valid choice that you made to Keep Up with the Kardashians.
Oh, no, I'm like amazing. Like, I think about them and how they affect society because they are.
Oh, yeah.
Like, really, like, what is it about? Like, this is obviously a group of women who are making so much money. A lot of them are women of color. They do interracial dating. Like, the joke is that they date black dudes. Like, what does that mean? How does that affect society?
Yeah.
One of them dated a dude and then just like refused to marry him and just had kids because she wanted to. So she made a choice that she didn't want to marry this dude. Yeah. And then also you see one dealing with the marriage of somebody who's battling an addiction. You see one of them, you see her face changes because technically like Kylie, like she was born as a white person. Kris Jenner is a white person. And so you see her change to look more Armenian, like her older sisters,
yeah.
her half-sisters. It's crazy.
Why do we watch anything else?
I know.
I don't know.
Jessica Williams speaking with us live at WNYC's The Green Space in New York City.
Yeah.
She'll be keeping you sane this election season on Comedy Central's Daily Show.
You'll hear more excerpts from our live show later in this episode, and we'll be posting additional outtakes from it on our podcast, which you can subscribe to via iTunes.
Actor Michael McKean is probably best known for his comedy roles. He was the charmingly dumb Lenny on the hit 70s sitcom Laverne and Shirley.
Yep.
I loved Lenny. And he played David St. Hubbins, lead singer of Spinal Tap,
yes.
the fictional heavy metal band he created along with Christopher Guest, as immortalized in the film This Is Spinal Tap.
But McKeon's latest role is a far cry from all that. He's on stage now at LA's Mark Taper Forum in Father Comes Home from the Wars, a finalist for last year's Pulitzer Prize for Drama. In it, he plays the Colonel, a Confederate officer who promises his slave freedom if he'll serve as his valet in the Civil War. It's a dark and complicated character. When I met with Michael, I first asked how he'd describe the Colonel.
He is a self-made man. And if you're a do-it-yourselfer, you know that self-made doesn't always mean quality.
Yeah, indeed.
He's a morally reprehensible person from the outside, but from the inside, which is the only way you can play a character, he makes all the sense in the world. And he does feel that his cause, in this case, the Confederate States of America, is the future.
You think that he legitimately does? Because this was going to be my next question. Is he does, he spends a lot of his time on stage justifying owning slaves and why slavery is justifiable.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much you, as the actor playing him, believe that he believes what he's saying.
I do think that he feels that's the way the future should be. That eventually everyone will come around to the fact that these inferior humans,
as the Colonel would say,
yeah, God gave us those people to do our work mm. and to make our economy sound and whole. Every now and then when we were rehearsing, I would have this kind of thought, Michael's thought, and would invade the Colonel's thoughts and say, geez, this was only about 150 years ago.
Yeah.
This is not like made up. And it's not like it happened, you know, in another galaxy far, far away. This is something that was the common stance of a great many Americans not that long ago.
I will say I'm surprised you consider him a 100% true believer in the Southern cause, because in a way I'm giving you an opportunity to let him off the hook a little bit, to say, you know, maybe on some level, because he actually does seem to love, on some bizarre
yes.
level, he loves his slave.
Oh, he
That's
does.
Why he asked him to join him in the war.
Yeah.
At one point, he breaks down crying, and you get the feeling that maybe he on a subatomic level, maybe knows that this is wrong and has to convince himself.
I think what is really crushing him is the notion that maybe this isn't the future. Maybe this is just the past. Maybe it's decaying. My wife and I read to each other. You know, we read novels and you know, to take turns reading chapters. Sure. We got about 700 pages into Gone with the Wind. Finally, we just had to put it aside because we got to a point finally where it was like, well, boo freaking who, you know, I'm sorry that this is all collapsing around your ears, but you know what? Hey, let's move on.
Yeah,
okay?
Maybe that society should have collapsed.
Maybe you should eat that root and shut up, you know?
So you have some sympathy for the character, but not an overabundance, it sounds like.
I think that there is something kind of pathetic about the colonel, but he's not completely unendearing. He's amusing. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You're never going to be on his side, but you will hopefully be amused.
Yes, he can tell a tale, let's say.
Yeah.
Bottom line, this is, you're playing nonetheless a very cruel character here. Mm-hmm. You also played the, let's say, controversial FBI boss, J. Edgar Hoover, on Broadway.
Yeah.
On the TV show Better Call Saul, you played the main character's brother, also not always the most likable character. Yeah. I grew up seeing you on Laverne and Shirley or in Spinal Tap playing these more or less genial characters. When did this change come to playing these heavier roles and why?
You know, it's interesting because I've played a lot of comical villains. You know, in the Brady Bunch movie, I was the, you know, I was the anti-Brady.
And this is really just an extension of that character, I feel, in a lot of ways.
The thing is, I just, you know, when you play the fool, sometimes you're the fool that they want to see doused in cement or something at the end. And, you know, if it works at the box office, then they offer you a lot more of those. And I've always been strong enough or solvent enough not to go with, I like to do something that I haven't done before.
Yeah, I guess my question is, did you consciously choose that path or did people start seeing you as like, hey, that guy would be a good heavy every now and then?
No, the first time I was ever really cast as a serious villain was in a movie that no one has seen. It's called Man Trouble with Jack Nicholson, Ellen Barkin, Beverly D'Angelo, Harry Dean Stanton. An amazing cast.
How did we not see that movie?
Because it's kind of a mess. I mean, through no fault of mine, certainly.
Oh, I would.
No, but I mean, I played a fairly scary guy, and the director, Bob Rafelson, asked me when I read, do you play a lot of heavies? And I said, never, which was the truth. I had never played anyone who was consciously creepy like that. And he goes, perfect. And he cast me on the spot. So I don't think it was anybody's first idea. But, you know, when it happens, it's the same thing. You find out what your character is after, and then you go get it.
Maybe on some level, I can imagine liking it more, because bad guys are in some ways, they're more driven and less tortured in some ways. Maybe.
I think Alan Rickman came along in Die Hard, we want all of our bad guys to be like that. Not because we liked him or wanted to cuddle with him, but because he was so damn competent and confident. You know, Tony Soprano, that's not a good man.
No.
But fascinated, and we did root for him in this kind of funny way. So I haven't really played anything like that, but I'd love to give it a shot. Helen Mirren, I worked with her very briefly in a movie. She was playing a pretty crappy person. And I said, boy, this is a really terrible woman here. And she said, you know, whenever I have anyone to play who is really awful to other people, I try and imagine what was done to her that made her this way.
Last question. And it's I'm going to be very disingenuous here. You appear in this play. You were first seen playing a banjo.
Yep.
So I take that as license to ask you about Spinal Tap, a documentary about a fake heavy metal band,
right,
of course. That movie made you a hero to actual metal bands. You know, I'm imagining you didn't hang out with heavy metal bands before that movie came out.
Not too much.
And I'm wondering, I would love to hear just a tale about finding yourself running with that crowd.
Well, I don't know whether I really have exactly one of those. We heard a lot of cases where people would come up to us and say, how did you know about what happened to us on tour? I said, well, we took a couple of wild guesses and, you know, we didn't know that your girlfriend became your manager and used astrology to replot the tour. We just made a guess and we had our make-believe girlfriend do that. But my favorite post-Tap moment is Jeff Beck has become kind of a friend and Chris Guest's look as Nigel is very similar to the way Jeff Beck carries himself.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, similar hair. You know, kind of.
Did he consciously do that? Did he base the character?
I don't know. But Chris is no fool when it comes to guitar players and everyone. I mean, Jeff is like the stuff. So he told us about a moment B.B. King's 75th birthday, I believe.
Okay.
Big concert at the Apollo in New York. So Beck and Clapton were going to do a guitar duel, and they got lost backstage. They got lost under
like
the
tap.
Stage at the Apollo. They just suddenly they looked at each other and they said, "We're in that movie."
Michael McKean, you can see him on stage now in the drama Father Comes Home from the Wars. It runs through May 15th at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles.
All right, coming up, we talk to Dick Cavett about talking to a Beatle, and it's not a Kafka thing, and we hear a beautiful new tune from Emmy the Great when the Dinner Party Download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. In a few minutes, we'll hear a brand new tune from Emmy the Great. But first, let's meet another special guest recorded at our recent live show at WNYC's The Green Space in New York City, Mr. Dick Cavett.
Yes, he's considered one of the greatest talk show hosts ever.
Indeed.
From the 60s through the 80s, his interviews with celebrities ranging from Gore Vidal to Jimi Hendrix were and are renowned for their humor and intelligence. The Onion AV Club said he, quote, proved good conversation makes good television.
He also was a regular columnist for the New York Times, and he's published several books, all of which we told our live audience by way of introduction, at which point Dick took the stage and admonished us thusly.
You left out one of my credits.
Really?
I once came in second in a Jessica Williams lookalike contest.
Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
That seems unlikely, but all right.
Proud moment.
So, Dick, since we last talked with you, you played yourself in the off... Do you remember this?
You know
everything.
You know everything.
In the off-Broadway production Hellman v. McCarthy, which is about a libel lawsuit that began in your late-night show. Tell us about playing yourself.
Well, I'll give a little background, though it's an elaborately long story, but two great famous American writers, Mary McCarthy and Lillian Hellman, were friends once. But things developed over the years, and Miss McCarthy, on a show of mine, decided to point out several things about Miss Hellman.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she said, the most memorable thing she said about it was, she's such a dishonest writer that even her thes and ands are lies.
Yes.
Now, Miss Hellman did not agree.
Neither did her lawyers.
No, in fact, you know way too much. But I got a call the next morning. Why didn't you defend me? And I said, well, Lillian, you don't ever seem to be like someone who needs defending.
Yeah.
Take care of yourself. And in a humorous mood, she sued me and PBS and at least three different parties. But anyway, it was a bitter thing. It was a long lawsuit. It played all over the papers and the news and the world of literature. And this play evolved from that. And one of the characters was named Dick Cavett. And it's a strange feeling, playing yourself. How do you play yourself? You can be yourself. That's not easy either on stage. But to play yourself... The sad part is I wasn't the first choice for the role.
Oh, my. Since we're talking about your acting, you were an actor and a writer first. You still are, obviously. And then at a certain point, your career became mainly about talking with other actors and writers. Tell us about that decision, if it was a decision that, you know...
You know, it wasn't a decision, really, when I was looking back on it. Of all the things I ever wanted to be, a talk show host was not among them. I wanted to be famous. Isn't that sickening?
We want to play a clip that we think illustrates the pros and cons of being a host.
Oh, okay.
And it's from your 1971 interview with George Harrison.
Are there more pros than cons here?
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about it afterwards.
Yeah.
So you're interviewing George Harrison. He's one of the biggest stars in the world, making a rare TV appearance. And he's promoting a film about Indian music called Raga.
I'll take your word.
And the Beatles have broken up, but a few minutes into the interview, you ask him about John Lennon.
Well, are you in any sense in contact with each other?
I saw him last night, actually, at the premiere of Raga.
Which what? Is what we should talk about, maybe.
Okay. But I mean, what did you say?
I said, hi, hello.
Yeah. Do you have writers who think of these things, or do you just have them ready and you can just snap them right out?
Yeah. Okay. We have writers home. And rooms what, full of them.
What did he come back with right away?
With, hi.
Gee, this ought to be... was there more, or did that just...
No. You've got real boring people, you know, to talk to on your show. I'm probably the biggest bore you've ever had on the show.
Really?
Mm.
You think?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be the judge of that. Listen, I'll tell you.
Well, I don't really, you know, they asked me, do you want to come on the Dick Cavett show? And I said, I got nothing to talk about, really.
Yeah.
They said, well, think of something, you know, anything. So I thought, okay, we'll go and talk about Rago, which is...
film.
Mm. Mm.
You mean that's it? When we're done talking about that, then...
Then I go.
You don't like to talk, then?
Well... Not really. Sometimes if there's something to say, but there's really nothing to say these days.
Oh my God. Nightmare.
Okay. Yeah.
Nightmare.
The fact is, for those who don't have a detailed memory of that show, I had had John and Yoko on, and then Harrison, and people said, you're going to try to do a 90-minute show with Harrison? Lots of luck. And some of it was like that, and then it got better and better and better as the show went on. And that's one of the arguments for long show is many guests in the 7 minutes they mostly get today aren't warmed up yet.
Well, we got to say goodbye to you, Dick. It's been great talking to you.
Sorry. That's I'm sorry. All the time we have for today.
Wait a minute. I'll be the judge of that.
So, in that moment, who are you thinking of? Are you thinking of your fragile ego saving, you know, defending yourself? Are you thinking of the guest making him more comfortable, or are you thinking of the audience?
The best thing you can do is, and it sounds so silly, try to listen to what the guest is saying. When I first did the show, I thought, what a nightmare. I'm going out there to do 90 minutes of television, improvised, and I don't know when to throw the commercial, and I don't know what's going on, and oh my God, I'm talking to this guest here, but maybe I'm supposed to be in a commercial now. And you look over at the guest, and the guest's lips have stopped moving.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And you have no idea what you were talking about or what they were talking about. And it's really scary. A lady producer I had said, when that happens to you, she said, I should have warned you about it. Have a sentence, a question, that will fit anybody at a time like that.
And what was your go-to?
Well, she suggested, do you pee in the shower?
That's so crazy. That's our next question.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Dick Cavett interviewed live at the Green Space at WNYC. You can catch vintage episodes of his talk show on the CBS channel Decades.
Yes, and by the way, Dick is also a champion anagrammer. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he provided us with a few examples too salty to broadcast. Check out our podcast, though, where we'll eventually post them to satisfy our audience's prurient interest.
That's right. And speaking of anagrams, the word Dick Cavett works out to CKTT advice.
Wow.
Which is as good a segue as any into the weekly advice column on the radio we call our etiquette segment.
Nice. At our live show, we asked Daily Show correspondent Jessica Williams to return to the stage to join Dick in answering etiquette questions from our audience. First up was a guy named Barry.
What do you do if a friend asks you about the dates for your wedding because he's looking to make travel arrangements, however, he's not on the guest list?
Oh. I know you want to grab that one.
No, I don't. Because, like, what am I going to say?
His name's not on the guest list. Okay.
All right.
Here's what I'd do. I would say there's been a mistake. The name that you saw as getting married is by an incredible coincidence, first and last name, someone else.
I'm not, in fact, getting
and
married.
The same bride name, someone else. Think of the odds against that. And if he doesn't get it by that time, he's not a Rhodes Scholar.
All right, I say you just got to ghost him. You got to ghost this dude because he's not somebody that could take a hint. But ghost means just like vanish on this dude. Do not haunt him. That's another version of ghosting.
No, you don't make love to him around a pottery wheel.
Yeah, don't do that.
That's, don't want to do that.
Often misunderstood.
No.
Don't
That's
try.
Just going to make him like you more.
That's a bad move.
All right, so Barry, but I have a question. Sorry, not to put you on the spot, but what do you do when a friend asks you? So this friend just didn't make it into that inner circle of the...
He knew we were getting married, and he had actually been at our engagement party, but a lot of people who were not invited to the wedding were at the engagement party. It was a casual thing.
Mm-hmm. But just it's ignore also that like, text. Why would you invite him to your engagement party and then not have people go to the wedding?
All right, don't get up, Barry.
I was ready to roast this dude, but you like... teased him.
This is not Springer.
And I know he's a jabroni, but you gotta invite him. You know what you did. You gotta clean this up. You gotta clean it up.
All right.
And I'm gonna say, you started on a weird foot in defense of that dude.
Aren't the rest of our etiquette question askers excited that we're about to turn to them?
Congratulations.
Michael, are you ready for some help?
Yes.
All right. I go out to dinner with a good friend regularly, but he never seems to have anything good to say about his meal. Out with a group, we'll all decide that the food is very good, but he will act like he's been presented with a bowl of inedible slop. This tends to bring down everybody at the table. He's generally good company, though, so I don't want to come out of these gatherings. How do I politely tell him to keep his mouth shut and enjoy his food?
How is he good company? Like, how? Thing I've ever heard. What are his good features, really?
Well, I mean, basically up until that point, he's really good company. He's really funny and...
But when the food arrives, it's all downhill.
He just starts to complain when the food arrives.
That's when the bitching starts.
Yeah. Dick, what do you think?
It strikes me, since I was at the dentist the other day, that you might get a bunch of that fabulous rubbery wax that they...
They used to put the dentures
and it hardens almost instantly.
Oh, they take a mold of your teeth, yeah.
Mix this in with the mashed potatoes. I think you can see where we're going.
Yeah, I think this is a good strategy. Are you listening, Michael? You weren't paying attention.
Cement his mouth, man.
Yeah, that's right. He's going to use the dental molding clay.
Blend it with the mashed potatoes.
And then his mouth will be shut.
Yeah.
Do you know a good dentist?
I got his card.
Yeah. All right, there you go, Michael. That's
hopefully one that's covered on your health plan.
Our next question comes from Dylan.
Dylan is a lady.
We're bringing so much happiness here.
It's really true.
Bringing joy to people's
lives.
It's
why we do this show.
So I'm pregnant.
Aww,
and thank you.
I just want to reach across and touch your stomach without permission.
So strangers frequently seem to think that my belly is free parking for their hands. How do you suggest that I handle these situations?
What?
That was weird, right?
You've got the same instinct, apparently.
I just wanted to just grab it. Well, I feel like it's similar to my hair.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think when people do that, I let them, if they're already in the it's all about that motion. So if they're already 75% of the way there, just let them finish and then flick them away. But if they ask, can I touch your belly? You say no, because this is like a child I'm making. Like my body is working.
Don't disturb it.
You're doing a crazy thing right now. People shouldn't just be grabbing your baby all willy-nilly.
Yeah.
Especially in this city. This is the dirtiest city ever.
Yeah,
that's true.
So don't let a maniac like me touch your baby.
Yeah. All right. Stay away.
Swat Jessica's
Stay
hand away.
Get away quickly.
All right, we got Michelle is up next.
I share an office with a coworker who is fine to work with, but is extremely competitive when it comes to things outside the office. I go to the gym, so she goes out of her way to tell me when she goes to the gym. She asks me what I made for lunch, then tells me about the incredible meal she made for dinner. Most recently, I ended a relationship, and right after asking me how I was doing, she proceeded to tell me about a bad breakup she went through in college and lost 5 pounds because of it. I'm not a competitive person, but this is getting annoying, and I'd like her to stop. What should I do?
Wow.
Well, I know what you should do. Do you live in a licensed carry area?
There you go.
There are certain states where this is an easy problem to finish off.
I mean, Jessica, can you top that?
I mean, she got to ghost this girl. You got to ghost this girl. There's no way she's ever going to be happy for you.
Yeah.
She's a co-worker, though.
But she's a co-worker, and they share an office.
Yeah, share an office.
Oh, you could easily ghost her. Like, you could I feel like you can co-worker ghost somebody better than, like, a friend ghost.
But you have to run into them all the time.
Can you shut down on her emotionally the way we would with our parents if they pried into her life?
I suppose. I'll have to try that.
So, I think we solved your problem, and the police will be coming for Dick Cavett. Talk show legend Dick Cavett and Daily Show correspondent Jessica Williams taped live in New York City. Look for more DPD live shows coming to a town near you.
And this would be a good moment to extend a huge thanks to our hosts at WNYC's The Green Space, Jennifer Sendro, Ellen Rolfes, Ricardo Fernandez, Jacqueline Cincata, and many others who made it happen.
Also thanks to our usual DPD crew, producer Jackson Musker, associate producer Nina Potok, associate digital producer Christina Lopez, executive producer Larissa Anderson, and interns Christian Kunz and Carla Javier, who, by the way, took advantage of our trip to New York to launch DPD's new Snapchat account. Mm. Check it out before it disappears.
And now, before we leave you, it's time for One for the Road, a song to spin on your way to or returning from this week's dinner parties.
Emmy the Great's debut album, First Love, was named one of the best of the year by the New York Times. Her new album, cunningly titled Second Love, just came out, and she joined us on stage in New York for a special rendition of her song, Swimming Pool.
Let's dive in.
You're so high. You look like a good time. A straight line in the sky. Jump into your blue swimming pool. And so clean and so new. I reach out to touch you, but you jump into your blue swimming pool. Hey, rich kid, I wanted the sunshine, your tan line, your good time, and your blue swimming pool. Love is something that I always thought I could never go inside. Now I've seen you here, and I don't know how I even used to be alive. Can I stay here for a while? Watch you till my heart unwinds, until I know I won't forget you. In your swimming pool. Rich kid, I wanted the sunshine, your tan line, your good time, and your blue swimming pool. Love is something that I always thought I could never go inside. Now I've seen you here, and I don't know how I even used to be alive. Can I stay here for a while? Watch you till my heart unwinds, until I know I won't forget you. And love is something that I always thought
I could never go inside. Now I've seen you here, and I don't know how I even used to be alive. Can I stay here for a while? Watch you till my heart unwinds, until I know I won't forget you. In your swimming pool. Ooh. Ooh. La la la. Jump into my swimming pool.
I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. Bon appétit.